This week's novel, Norwegian Wood by Haruki Murakami, may strike you as an unusual or even dull choice for our Love of February series because with love it's quite unconventional. People simply ignore how Murakami treats love in this novel, and I'm here today to say that it's time to stop. Welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin. Norwegian Wood. My theory about this novel in regards to Murakami's new novel, Killing Commendatore, is that he uses Norwegian wood as a launching pad for the motifs and theories that he wants to perfect later in his life. There are the usual Murakami-isms, and I'll read a list quickly. Ears, cats, food, alcohol, he tends to prefer whiskey, opera, jazz, records, age, infidelity, Sundays, the surname Watanabe, gender roles, traditional and non-traditional, facial expressions, and people with unique or unusual diction, but then there are concepts present that differ from book to book. What I have noticed, however, especially after reading the two novels so close together, is that thematically the books are very similar, which is unusual for Murakami. One of the marketing taglines of Killing Commendatore, and one of the reasons why it's such a big deal, is that it is a, quote, loving homage to The Great Gatsby, i.e. one of Murakami's heaviest influences and one of the most prominent novels in literature, period. In other words, people don't just casually mention that their book meets Gatsby unless some serious business is about to go down. Norwegian Wood, now that I'm able to give it that lens, certainly has subversive, almost hidden workings that bring things back to The Great Gatsby, but it's certainly not as overt as Killing Commendatore is. To give some examples, The Great Gatsby is often quoted because Toru, the main character, oscillates between rereading The Great Gatsby and another novel. He meets a minor motivating character, Nagasawa, through reading The Great Gatsby, and he certainly, Nagasawa, that is, has Gatsby elements like his sense of longing and searching in the dark, as well as his stark individualism and his confidence. Here's a quote from Nagasawa, actually. If you only read the books that everyone else is reading, you can only think what everyone else is thinking. Conversely, the main love interest, Naoko, can be said to be a kind of daisy figure because of her elusiveness and skittishness, especially in regards to important decisions like who she's going to spend her life with and what she wants to do. The scenes with dying old men are also very similar, and the characters reflect on death as well as the artistry of life in those scenes. Most pertinent to me when I was reading those descriptions was the emphasis of the men withering away, which I found to be simultaneously beautiful and grotesque. I've heard it said that 1Q84 is Murakami's masterpiece, but after reading Killing Commendatore, I beg to differ. Honestly, Killing Commendatore is very good. The problem, in my opinion, with 1Q84 is that Murakami struggles with pacing, resulting in a narrative that tires itself out over its 1,000-page duration. That's why if you've been a long-time listener in the few first episodes, I often comment that Murakami's writing is best suited to shorter durations, or sprints, if you will, like in shorter stories or shorter novels, like Norwegian Wood, for example. Lately, though, as I have gone back and read books like The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle and Killing Commendatore, which are both around 600 pages in length, I am finally convinced that he has found his footing along the way. If allowed to digress further, I would say that there's some pressure for contemporary writers to author superbly long books in the efforts of unearthing a so-called masterworks status. This works in two ways, either super well or not so well. We see that this happens time and time again in the literary world, like with David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, Lillo's Underworld, 1Q84, I mean, the examples are pretty much endless. Finally, let's get into Norwegian Wood a bit more. The novel was published in 1987, intentionally with the same name as the Beatles song, which is explicitly mentioned in the novel. Interestingly enough, the novel's genre is listed as Bildungsroman instead of contemporary fiction, which would certainly be where I would place it, and actually Bildungsroman is essentially an instructive or reflective tale based on the key years of one's life. So there's a bit of an outer frame at the beginning of the novel that I believe is never revisited, and Toru is 38 years old and reflecting on an airplane about his relationship with Naoko, but I would still say that the key components of the story focus on broader arenas like Japanese and Americana ideals, what builds character and personality, and of course love, but perhaps that's just me. A short summary, full of spoilers as per usual, is that the book is based on the early 20s of Toru Watanabe as he attends university for a degree in drama and is heavily affected by the events of his life during those few years. He meets Naoko, a gentle, ethereal girl, quite by accident, though we find out later that she was his dead best friend Kazuki's girlfriend. They develop a quick, albeit unusual, relationship, and just at the point where things start to escalate, Naoko disappears. Several minor characters are explored in more depth at this time, including Stormtrooper, his roommate, who is a neat freak and does radio calisthenics early in the morning, one of my favorite characters, Nagasawa, an upperclassman from a successful family who takes Toru bar and hotel hopping at nights, and Midori, a classmate of Toru's that serves as a foil for Naoko and a close friend for Toru. Eventually, it is revealed that Naoko committed herself to a Mii hostel, a soft sanitarium of sorts. Toru visits her and meets Reiko, a motherly woman who is Naoko's roommate with a dark past of her own. I'm glossing over some of the later developments, but near the end of the book, Naoko commits suicide. Norwegian Wood generally is a great first novel to read when it comes to Haruki Murakami. It is fairly representative of his writing, and the pacing is just right for a novel of this length and concept. I was actually going to do this episode entirely on pacing, but decided that it might have gotten too technical to be accessible to people, so here we are. The novel is also not as fantastical as many of his other works, so there are a few scenes that serve as the exception to this, but for the most part, it's fairly realistic and concurrently very digestible to new audiences that are used to very realistic reading. Now more into the analysis. Love comes in a myriad of different forms in this novel, so I'm going to start with the most obvious relationship and the one that's the most conventional, which is between Toru and Naoko. The interesting thing about their relationship over the course of the novel is the number of bases it covers. Emotional, mental, physical, unrequited, stable and unstable, etc., etc. So even though it seems like the most conventional relationship in the novel, it actually turns out to be quite complex. In the end though, I'm going to lean towards the relationship being an interesting case of unrequited love on Toru's end, because it seems that Naoko is incapable of reaching beyond herself for anything else, be it love or companionship or education of any sort. This is an unpopular opinion, but I actually think that she ends up becoming somewhat sociopathic in the novel due to her subtly manipulative and narcissistic qualities. I've written several papers on sociopathy in literature, so it's possible that this is more so on my radar than other people, but I do think that she fits the categories in the DSM-4. My evidence for this lies on page 286 for those of you with the vintage edition. I was overcome with a sense of my own defilement. Though I returned to Tokyo, I did nothing for days but shut myself up in my room. My memory remained fixed on the dead rather than the living. The rooms I had set aside in there for Naoko were shuttered, and the furniture draped in white, the windowsills dusty. I spent the better part of each day in those rooms, and I thought about Kazuki. "So you finally made Naoko yours," I heard myself telling him. "Oh well, she was yours to begin with. Now maybe she's where she belongs." But in this world, in this imperfect world of the living, I did the best I could for Naoko. I tried to establish a new life for the two of us. But forget it, Kazuki. I'm giving her to you. You're the one she chose, after all. In the woods as dark as the depths of her own heart, she hanged herself. Once upon a time, you dragged a part of me into the world of the dead, and now Naoko has dragged another part of me into that world. Sometimes I feel like a caretaker of a museum, a huge, empty museum where no one ever comes, and I'm watching over it for no one but myself. So this passage is chiefly devoted to Kazuki, but I do think that it says something about Naoko, that she's able to leave this world in the way that she conducted herself in it, which is to say, she's a fairly narcissistic person, and I'm not saying that this suicide was a selfish act, which I'm sure it can be put that way in some instances, but I am saying that she makes decisions with only her interests in mind. Naoko is obviously a very complex character, and we never get her point of view, and we also never get really direct scenes with her. It's always shrouded in this very fluffy prose, so there's a lot of dissecting that the individual reader has to do in regards to Naoko. But anywho, that is my opinion from reading this book several times and dissecting Naoko as I do. I wanted to mention that there are also some lesbian scenes and some more subdued friendship scenes in the book that time unfortunately does not allow me to delve into, but I will say that those scenes are worth looking into and thinking about. I suppose to look at the one gay scene for a minute, it's a scene that serves as a turning point for the character Reiko in the book, and different in the way that the power dynamics are totally skewed in that instance. So a 13-year-old is the most powerful person in that circumstance, and she's also the abuser. And the event itself is extremely psychologically traumatizing for Reiko, but in a way it's unexpected, and Murakami ends up using those acts as a device to propel questions of romanticism and sexual conduct for the rest of the novel, so it is a relatively effective scene to look at, especially in terms of pacing. Midori and her father also have an interesting relationship in the book, and one worth discussing at that. One component that is often overlooked with excuses of Midori's frivolity by readers is her lie to Toru about her father. So initially she tells him that he packed up and moved to Uruguay after her mother's tragic death, a reasonable response considering her description of the situation, but we later come to learn that in reality her father is in the hospital dying of the same kind of brain tumor that killed her mother only a year before. I'm actually of the opinion that this white lie is an act of sort of defiant love on Midori's part, almost like she's protecting her father and his image from outsiders like Toru. And especially when Toru is allowed in, it's one of the most climactic and carefully crafted intermediary moments in the book, and one where he contributes to nursing her father and over time grows more open to conversations about mortality, death, and of course love. The moment to further my point is only emphasized by Midori's intense love for her father, because Toru, as a character, is very sponge-like and mirrors that love in a curiously objective way. Overall, I really enjoyed my second pass at Norwegian Wood, and it was a cool first novel of 2019 to dissect along with y'all. If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there is an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes, which should be available on whatever podcasting app you're using. If you need some guidance, try episode 21 about Joan Didion's The White Album. I really enjoyed making that episode, and it's the first that was published in 2019, which is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course new projects and episodes relating to DH&I. Also stay tuned for the next episode. In 2 days' time, we will be looking at Chasing Red by Isabel Ronin. It's a modern romance novel. I think you guys are going to like it. Still there? One more thing then. Remember that leaving a comment or review on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, or any other Guilty Pleasure podcast platform helps leverage the show so that other literature enthusiasts can find the community. In other words, it helps a ton. Auf Wiederhören!